The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. Well, at last, the President of the United States and Mr. Kissinger have both spoken out very strongly against the policies of Arab oil as a political weapon, and against the Arabs for jacking the oil price out of sight, which may, in fact, end up sending the entirety of the Western civilized world into economic chaos. And it appears that it's already doing a very good job of just that. I certainly applauded those twin speeches given almost simultaneously recently. And now we'll wait to see what the reaction is going to be. I mean, when Mr. Ford called for a United Nations energy and food plan and got all of that reaction from Arab states who said there was some kind of a veiled threat there that the United States of America may cut off certain aid or food or use some of its giveaway policies to Arab countries and others alike in retaliation, oh, they were incensed. They were enraged. You know, when I look at the history of the United States of America, especially in the post-World War II era, we have been in the business of giving of our substance, of our wealth, of our energy, of our expertise and know-how, and of our money, including our military hardware, more than I guess any other civilization. I'm sure that that's a safe statement in the history of all of the world. There has never been a nation on the face of the earth who has been any more benevolent or altruistic, who has been in the business of giving away of its own substance than the United States of America. And all of that's expected. I don't know if you read an article recently about one of the smaller nations in Africa, where certain reforms were underway and where it was a prime target for the recipient of foreign aid, because it seemed that in this one unique case in Africa, the nation receiving the aid was actually using the aid for the purposes for which it was received. And that was incredible. The money, the goods, the food, the plowshares, the whatever, went straight to the people and to the programs for whom it was intended. And this was fantastic. Well, in the meantime, a ringing slap had been delivered to the face of Uncle Sam. But as the person at the other end of the receiving of the aid was overheard to say, "Oh, well, it doesn't make any difference. If you think for one minute the United States is going to cut off aid just because we're a little intractable or hostile or vote against them in the United Nations or a little hard to get along with, why, don't you people know that the more we act up, why, the more eager the United States is to give us more?" I mean, words to that effect. He came right out and said it. He said, "Why, doesn't history since World War II show you that the more a nation that is recipient of U.S. aid slaps the United States in the face, the more the givers of the aid scramble to give more?" I mean, it's unbelievable, isn't it? Now, if we lived way back during the days of, was it President Madison, I believe it was, who sent Stephen Decatur and the Marines over to Tripoli? You know, in those days when the Tripoli pirates came out with their, and these were ships that were rowed with oars so that they didn't have to trust to the winds, and they were levying hideous taxes, which was nothing more than open seas piracy upon ships from Italy, from Spain, from France, from England, and also from the United States. Well, that was interrupting the free world's trade. Those were trading vessels, and they carried raw materials and goods and supplies, and they were trading in the Middle East. And no doubt they were trading oil, although in those days it would have been olive oil. And those Tripoli pirates would come out and levy absolutely impossible to pay, virtually, surcharges when they had no business doing so. It was open seas piracy. All the other nations decided to take it. But the United States of America in those days decided not to take it. And so Stephen Decatur and a portion of the United States fleet loaded with Marines went over to Tripoli. And they took care of the pirates. Now, I think I hear the subdued hoots, shrieks, and snorts of derision of some of our modern-day products of America's universities, who would say that's interfering in the internal affairs of a foreign country. I mean, after all, if they wanted to charge 50% of the cargo's value or something like that to an American ship far at sea in the middle of the Mediterranean, that was their business. And we shouldn't have gone over there to interfere with them. Well, the reason you hear in the Marine Corps hymn, "From the Halls of Montezuma to the Shores of Tripoli," is because that is a part of United States Marine Corps history. It was one of those proud moments in American history where piracy on the high seas, which threatened not just the United States, but the entirety of the world in that sense, and free trade for free trading nations around the world, the United States decided to do something about it. And it reacted with strength and with purpose and resolve. Now, whether or not the United States is going to decide to do anything besides talking is certainly a moot question today, but at least I'm very glad to see that the President and the Secretary of State have spoken out and called a spade a spade. As Mr. Kissinger said, the decision to raise prices of oil was a political decision, and the decision to lower prices of oil could also be a political decision. It was not an economic decision. It was not a necessary decision. It was a purely political decision. Now, you and I both know that since the Yom Kippur War and the Arab oil embargo, the entirety of this world has been thrown into a tailspin. We know that we have entered a new era, and we know that now statesmen are having to resort to doomsday language to even define the days in which we live. And we know that every single time we pick up a newspaper, we get the jitters, we get the frights and the scares, we're a little more apprehensive and nervous than we were the day before. You know, the S&Ls are in trouble, that's the big savings and loans banks, because people are pulling the cash savings out of those deposits and trying to buy quicker maturing and higher interest rate treasury notes and government bonds and the like, and now even some of the big S&Ls in the country are having to ask for government action to try to save some of the big savings and loan corporations in the United States. All of this is a combination of fear and worry about skyrocketing prices, inflation, increasing shortages, and yet at the same time we continue to ship millions of bushels of food grains overseas, in some cases to the very countries who are slapping us up alongside the ear with ringing slaps and spitting in our eye and kicking us on the shin. And as I asked recently, if we are to place our trust, our faith, our hope in foreign nations for our future safety and that of our children and grandchildren, then maybe that's the way to play the game. But what if we decided to trust God? What if we decided in the United States of America to trust God? What if we decided to keep His laws, to return to His Word, to discover what is our individual and our national purpose in the light of the fact of the existence of an all-wise Creator God who laid down certain laws by which humankind ought to live, who set down as living, active principles certain hazards and benefits, certain risks and rewards, certain causes and certain effects? Because that's the story of the Bible. You've got to consider the hazards versus the benefits. God's law lays down automatic consequences for obedience and automatic consequences for disobedience. You break God's laws and you get broken. The simplest example of that is the law of gravity. You jump out a window, you get hurt. That's all there is to it. It's inexorable, and it works. Now, the very same thing is true when you talk about chemicals. There are known chemical mixtures which can kill you. There are known chemical mixtures which explode. There are known quantities of electricity which, when they bombard your body, will simply stop your vital processes. There are laws that chemists and engineers and people who are dealing in sound designs in aerodynamics and such as rocketry and space travel and aircraft and the like, and they have to get in conformance with those laws, or the thing simply doesn't work. There are laws that really must be observed in chemical laboratories. There are laws that must be observed with regard to physical health, with your own body, with your diet, with a balanced intake of different kinds of foodstuffs, a balance between some of the sugars and starches and the acids and the things that you eat, so that you don't become imbalanced in one direction or the other, and some of your vital functions begin to be interrupted. Very few people seem to pay all that much attention to those natural laws, and of course they are reaping the consequences. There is a cause for every effect. The effect might be all kinds of debilities, sickness, headaches, an early death even through emphysema or through perhaps a heart attack or cancer. The biggest killer now, heart disease and all the related cardiovascular diseases of mankind because of our soft, easy living, lack of exercise, starchy, sugar-rich foods, but we go on anyway. But these are laws. Now, some of the laws we break are going to kill us gradually. It might take 20 years, 30 years, or 50 years, but they're going to get us. Other laws that we break could kill us instantly. What we don't see is that the spiritual laws we break make us unhappy. They ruin our lives. They rob us of our sleep. They wreck our marriages. They destroy the attitude of our children. They disrupt and tear apart the very vitals of social institutions. It's broken laws and principles of God that lie at the root of racism, of greed, of lust and covetousness, which causes one person after another to jack up prices and to pass along the price increase. If you were to look at any little commodity that you almost daily use and you were to say, why is that price going up? All you've got to do is ask how many people touched it. Through how many human hands did it pass? Where did it come from originally? Take a grain of wheat. It came out of the field. But how did it get in the field? The farmer had to buy a grain of wheat and plant that stalk. How did he do that? Well, it cost him a lot of money to buy seed wheat, and seed wheat was in short supply there for a while, and some of the various strains that we've developed are a little softer and aren't quite as durable as the hard red wheats and so on that are grown in good, healthy soil, monoculture, all the problems of crop blight, of late springs, of early frost that we're hearing about, those are problems for the farmers. Sometimes the farmers are virtually wiped out by things beyond their control. So the farmer didn't make a crop last year, or he lost 50% of the crop last year. He didn't have the money this year. So he had to go head over heels in debt with the bank, probably even to borrow on the seed for next year's crop. In the meantime, what else happened to the farmer? Well, the price of his machinery was going up. Why? Oh, there are dozens of reasons why. How many people touched it? How many people worked on it? How many parts manufacturers and components produced parts that went into that piece of machinery? That's why. Oil, gasoline, butane, and, of course, the petrochemical oil-based fertilizers and some of the sprays that he has to use. These also went up, didn't they? So again, the farmer is being passed along all kinds of price increases by greedy people who say, wait a minute, I'm making 15%, I'm making 12%, I'm making 9%, I'm making 3%. I don't care what you pick out of the hat, but I'm making X percent of profit this year. Because others are passing along to me higher prices, my profit margin is now going to be Y instead of X. It's still a profit, but it's not enough. It's not the same as last year. So since I am not willing to operate on a slightly lower profit margin, I will pass along that price increase to the next guy. So the farmer looks at his machinery, at his oil and diesel, at his fertilizer and his pesticides, at his costs to get the aircraft or someone else to spray it or apply it, his labor costs, at such simple things as twine, such simple things as what we used to call gunny sacks or tote sacks, just to sack the stuff. The price of boxes and crates. And all of these things are up. So the farmer says, like anybody else, well, there are about a dozen different people here that are raising prices for me. Therefore, my margin of profit is being hurt. So to maintain the exact same margin of profit, or even to increase it a little bit, because we like to expect annual increases from last year, the price of my product must go up. Now we're back to that little grain of wheat. Now, it's been planted, it's grown to a stalk, it's come to a head, it's ripened, you might get down on your knees and hope and pray. But if it has, and when it has, it is then threshed, it's then harvested out of the field. And then somebody else begins to mess with it. somebody in a grain bin, somebody in a silo, or somebody called the United States Agriculture Department. Now it's stored. But you know, some of these people who are in the business of storing grain are also brokers in grain. They buy the grain. And sometimes they hang on to it and they barter. And when you listen to the sounds of some of the barkers in grain brokerages, it sounds like Hip to Hootie, Come and See the Naughty Nudie nightclub act of the 1930s with the old thug, the bald head, and the great big scar across his nose who says, I can take on all comers. I mean, you can't believe it. It's worse and louder than a stock auction. You never heard anything like it. Grain brokers. You ever been to a grain brokerage? You ever heard them shouting and scrubbing the names and the numbers and the figures on and off the blackboards? Why, grain can fluctuate as wildly as the stock market. And so they're buying and bartering and trading and selling. Now, this is the second guy that's touching the grain of wheat. And, of course, they've got to make a living, haven't they? And they've got to keep their margin, haven't they? And if they can make a killing a few years ago, they did. And that made the farmers really bitter. The farmers were leaked a lot of rumors that the federal government was going to hold prices at a certain level. The farmers sold low. Then the granary operators hung on to it. That's the second man to get a hold of that grain of wheat. And they hung on and hung on and hung on until the price went out of sight. And it was alleged that a lot of them knew about it in advance because of huge grain shipments and sales overseas. And they sold high. So they ended up making a fantastic margin. I don't know whether it was 40% or 50%. It was unbelievable. I forget because it was a couple or 3 years ago now. So the next year, the farmers decided we're going to wait and wait and wait and we're going to sell late. And, of course, you say nobody can blame anybody because we're all playing this game of lying to one another, cheating one another, taking advantage of one another, being just as greedy or maybe a little more so than our neighbor. So, therefore, we all say, it's not my fault. It's that rotten so-and-so unprintable expletive-deleted's fault. It's not my fault. So-and-so there's raising all of his prices. And so, naturally, I've got to raise mine. Okay, so far that little grain of wheat is right now nestling inside about a million bushel granary someplace out in the middle of Kansas. And its life has been tenuous and frightening. It just barely got to harvest. It's only one of those grains of wheat out of millions and millions that didn't survive. But there it is. Now, it's already been handled by really, in a sense, lots of people. All those guys that had to do with the farmers' rising costs and all those people that have to do with the costs as they are sometimes artificially set, raised and lowered by the brokers or by the government. And it's not necessarily, don't kid yourself, the law of supply and demand. It sometimes has nothing to do with supply and demand. So far, so good. We got two people messing around with that grain of wheat. All right, let's say this particular lot of wheat stays here domestically, and it's purchased by one of the big and well-known national brands that you see on the boxes of prepared and frozen and pounded and pummeled and beat up and whipped and added and chemically preserved and flavored and dyed and colored and boxed and packaged and plasticked and sold to you at unbelievable prices, called by some little girl's name. It might be Old Maud or it might be Young Tilly, but not to identify any one particular one. It might come to you in the form of anything from breakfast cereal, which sounds like Yul Gibbons just broke every tooth in his head when he crunched on it, or like shattered glass falling on the floor, or it might come to you like some kind of a white, bland, smooth goop that is kind of not unlike pablum with a lump stirred out that you serve to babies. But there it is. That little grain is on its way to one of these nationally known, or maybe it's even a local bakery where it's going to be made into bread. But in any event, now you take a look at what happens from the grain bin. Now, you know, it had to get to the grain bin. We left out one thing from the farm, and it might have gotten there via the rails or via trucks, and if it was a trucking firm, the trucking firm will tell you that everything is out of sight. Trucks have gone up, tires have gone up, drivers want more wages. Truck drivers make as much now as airlines pilots used to only a decade or so ago. It's unbelievable. But at any rate, everything's going up, so it costs a lot more money to ship that bushel of wheat from the farm to the granary. Then it costs a lot more money to ship it again from the granary to this place where it's going to be milled. Now, when it gets to the mill, if it's one of the big mills, the mill will tell you every price has gone up. All the workers find out that there's wage increase needed because of all the price of bread. See, bread's going up. So they need a wage increase to keep up with it. This is almost like we are made of all kinds of little cells, and those cells are like hollow little pockets, like balloons. And we've got about 16,000 little old nozzles hanging out of us. And one day, we grab a hold of one of those nozzles and we just puff up a part of our body. And that makes the cells of the balloons next to it envious, and they say, hey, look, this one part here is all puffed up. I want to be puffed up like that. So you grab the next nozzle and you blow that up. Pretty soon you look like the Goodyear blimp with lights blazing and you're floating around in the sky. And then one of these days, you know, you try to land on a prickly pear patch or something, and blowy, a blast all over the landscape. And we're just puffing ourselves up, blowing ourselves up for no purpose whatsoever. It's a ridiculous, bizarre game. If we want to, we can add zeros clear on across three bills and tape three of them together and call them zillion-dollar bills, and we can all be zillionaires. That's what we want, isn't it? We want all the money? Fine, just change the $1 bills into billion-dollar bills. We can be just like Germany in 1923 and 4, and we can pay $4 billion for a stamp and $5 or $6 billion for a loaf of bread and go to the grocery store with a wheelbarrow full of the stuff. That's where we're headed, you know. Because everybody else is to blame, aren't they? Sure they are. We know that. We know it's not us. We're not willing, like Pogo, to say we have identified the enemy and he is us. We're saying, no, let George do it. It's the other guy. Well, back to the grain of wheat. It gets to the mill. But the miller says that he's got to pay higher wages. And people go on strike to get those because they say the price of bread's going up. Now there is the processing of it, the packaging of it, and then the sending of it to a supermarket. But first it probably goes to a distributor. And that distributor then is dealing with supermarkets or big supermarket chains or even your local grocery store. So there's another middleman between the big national miller and the retailer. And that's a distributor or a wholesaler. He has to add a markup. Why? Well, because he's running trucks, and he's got employees, and he's got central agencies and warehouses and supply, you know, depots set up here and there. And so he's got to add his part to it. Then it gets finally to the retailer, and here it is, this packaged, pummeled, processed, re-dried, revitalized, rejuvenated, chemically additive thing. It's got formulas on it, which it takes you three high school, college, and postgraduate degrees to even figure out. And it's got every kind of preservative that started clear back to the way they prepared the soil in which they grew the grain of wheat, what they sprayed on it when it was young, what they sprayed on it before it was harvested, what they sprayed on it to preserve it in the bin, and then what they sprayed on it while they were processing it, and then how they took the wheat germ, and probably then with it they took the husk where all the real nutrient is, and the skin of the wheat, where most of all the real good vitamins are that you need, and they kept that internal, that white pulpy part, where they call it high protein, which is a little bit misleading. Now that they've got that white starchy flour and thrown all the good part away, they've got to add all these chemicals to it to make it good, palatable. And if you get brown bread, you're getting white bread with brown dye. I mean, it's just one more additive, which is one more color, which is likely to one of these days give you some brown, unpleasant warts under your arm or something. I'm not sure it'll do that to you, but then nobody's sure it won't. We don't know exactly what these things are doing to us. We know that we're ingesting our daily diet of poison, but we don't really seem to be too terribly worried about that. Well, finally, here it is, and you squeeze it. And you know it's going to be fresh. This is now, you know, say September. It was put on the shelf in March. But it's still fresh because it's got all those. It could never rot. I mean, you couldn't find a fungus among us on some of that bread because it just won't grow mold. A self-respecting mold wouldn't get close to a piece of chemicals like that. Anyway, the loaf of bread is now going out of sight, and you go to the supermarket, and you complain. You say, why in the world is bread going up? And the guy that's running the market says, well, because, do you know how much I have to pay for that bread? Why they're passing along to me a price increase. So you go back to the wholesaler or the distributor and you say, why did you raise your prices? He says, well, because the processor did, the factory did. You go to the factory and say, why did you raise your price? Well, because, did you know what the brokers are doing to us this year? The price of grain is going out of sight. You go to the broker and you say, why are you charging more? Now, I don't know what his story is going to be, but he's probably going to say, well, because the farmers wanted more this year. You go to the farmer and you ask him, why are you charging more? Why do you want more? Why do you hold back or plant less or hold it longer or try to store it yourself or use any possible method you can to get more money for your... I've got to have more money. The price of everything's going up. We got to have food and clothing and recreation and automobiles and equipment. And I've got to buy wire and twine and gasoline and diesel fuel and machinery and pay my hired employees. You know, it reminds me, one time I was in South America with my Spanish professor, El Doctor Benjamin Rea, Dr. Benjamin Ray, as they called him down there. And everything was locked up on this one day, and we didn't know it was a national holiday of some kind. Anyway, we were getting down to the last little bit of cash, and I wanted to cash one of these American Express traveler's checks for about $20 or so. I had to borrow from the bank to take that trip to help finance it. I paid 50% and paid on it for 2 years, and the work financed the other 50%. At any rate, we were asking all over town where we could find a bank that was open, or someplace, some kind of a store that would cash this check so we could at least go out to eat. Well, we had asked five or six places, and we'd been on this and that wild goose chase, and finally we pulled up in this little plaza, and there were a couple, three guys standing over there. And Ben Ray got out of the car, and he walked over there, and I could see him gesticulating and asking these two people the old tired question, where in the world are we going to find a bank that is open? With military precision, almost clicking their heels, they both turned and pointed in exactly opposite directions. And that is precisely what is happening in inflation. The farmer points to everybody who is hurting him in twine, baling wire, fuel, gasoline, diesel, machinery, wages, his own costs, blight, late spring, early thaw, or early frost, as the case may be, everything of the kind. He says, I've got to charge more. The grain bin operator says, the farmer wants more, I've got to charge more. And so then the miller says, the grain bin and the brokers are charging more, I've got to charge more. The distributor and the wholesaler says, the millers are charging more, I've got to charge more. The supermarket says, all these guys are charging more, I've got to charge more. The consumer says, I've got to pay more, therefore I've got to make more wages, so I'm going to go on strike because I'm helping deliver the wheat. How dumb can we get? Inflation is everybody's problem, and it's going to take everybody to whip it, not just one or two people. Well, I see that I've just about run out of time, and I can't even get into the book of Jeremiah, so I'll have to do that next time in this new series that I've begun. In the meantime, you write for the current number of the Plain Truth magazine and get these articles on Jordan's King Hussein, an in-depth look at the soul of Russia, the article on the family that drinks together, and a new feature called World Watch, and also the booklet, Is This the End Time? They're free of charge and no price, and all you need to do is to request it by sending your letter to Post Office Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Be sure to tell us the call letters of your station. We need that. That's all. There is no cost, but tell us the name of the radio station to which you've been listening, the call letters, and then send your letter to Box 345, Sydney, New South Wales. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have been listening to The World Tomorrow. If you would like more information, write to Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO, Sydney, New South Wales. That's Ambassador College, Box 345, GPO, Sydney, New South Wales.